It's time to talk about the issues you want to talk about. This is Barely Controlled Radio with your host, former Pittsburgh Steelers place kicker Jeff Reed. Jeff's got his opinions, but he knows you have some too, and he's ready to field them all. Now, here's Jeff Reed and Barely Controlled Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Barely Controlled Radio, live from the Man Cave back in Pittsburgh, PA. Got a special guest in the house attending a charity event. It would be his. But, you know, I do a lot of these random podcasts that I think are great. Some they may suck to a lot of people. And I also, when I have guests on, I like to get a little bit of their background, dig into their childhood, see where they came from, not just the stars and the celebrities they are today. So without much else to say, I guess this is Charlie Batch in the Man Cave today. Barely Controlled Radio. What's up, man?
Not much, man. How you doing?
I'm good. What you been up to these days?
Right now enjoying the retired life a little bit. Finally kicked me out the league, you know, after 15 years.
Yeah,
but
sucks.
Hey, you know, that's
15. That's six more than me, buddy.
But other than that, man, actually busy with my foundation. We are now in year number 14. We have 13 different programs, and we now touch 3,100 kids annually in five different counties throughout the Pittsburgh area. So I'm excited about that as we continue to grow.
Man, that's cool, man. That's great. You know, a lot of people look at Charlie as an ex-quarterback. Not only did he play here in Pittsburgh, and he's from Homestead, which is basically the waterfront area, but he played a lot of other teams. But it's, he's a businessman to me. And the reason I say that is it's not because I didn't respect him as a quarterback. It's because, you know, you always find out when you're out of football what your calling is. You kind of figure out who you are. And it took me until about a year ago to figure out who I really was, because I was defining myself by not being in the league. So that means football was defining me, and that's it was a problem of mine. But I've come a long way. And even in the locker room while Charlie was playing, he was always doing business things, not just charity stuff, bringing stuff to us if guys didn't know what to do with their money, or good investments, bad investments, or opportunities. For financial advisors, and that's, what people out there don't understand is they think you play football and the money's great, and it is, and all those good things. But, there's more to it. And I talked to Pouncey about that, too. And I kind of feel like football defines him, because I said, if you played your last snap last week, what would you do with your life? It's good you got paid so you can support yourself financially and your family. And he said, well, I'd give back to my high school in Lakeland, Florida, and I just hope football's not over. And it didn't sound like he was stupid or anything, but it was, I just didn't see where, but he's young, so
a lot of people are like that.
When
they get to that point, the problem is when they're, at least for me, and I'll use my example, where I've been in this so-called boys club since I was 7 years old. So you go through, you're playing little league ball, you're playing high school all the way up through college. Then all of a sudden you get to the National Football League and you still are playing football. So you never really had an opportunity to figure out what that other side looks like.
Right.
And the longer that you're in the league, the longer you are away from what that whatever job description or whatever you're going to do with life after football, it takes you away from that. So you don't have an opportunity to kind of fulfill what that looks like. But for me, knowing and having that opportunity to be home, I didn't know how long I was going to be. I played 4 years in Detroit, came back here, Pittsburgh in 2002. And every year I treated it as if it was going to be my last. So I tried to go out, network, and meet a lot of people, because I knew Pittsburgh was going to be home for me. And that was just something that, I tried to take advantage of. And luckily, I was able to be here 11 years and go to 3 Super Bowls. You win 2. So, life is a little easier when it comes down to meeting people from that aspect. But it's just something that I always thought of, the end game. What happens if this was to be completely over? And I just was able to go out there and kind of develop that throughout my time. But it didn't happen right away. It happened right around year 6, 7, 8. That's when I started thinking about, okay, what else am I going to do?
Yeah, you hit on a couple things there. And basically what you were saying is what you always hear growing up, have a backup, have a mm-hmm. backup plan, have a plan B if plan A doesn't work out. And I knew I wanted to do something journalism, but I didn't know I was going to have a podcast. My producer, Nathan Black, he said, you know, have you ever thought about doing a podcast? And I said, yeah, well, what the hell do I do?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I like the radio. I think my opinion matters, things like that. But now what? You know, mm-hmm. I'm definitely not a technology freak. So, but then you also hit on something that I want to focus on football, and then we'll get into more of your charity stuff and your personal life, because I know you're doing some cool things on TV and radio now, you know, in your business-like. And you hit on a couple of things. First of all, you lost the Super Bowl to Green Bay because I wasn't there. That's number one. So we'll get that out of the way. And see, I was on the team that whole year. I got you guys there.
Yeah.
But then I didn't get to play, which shout out to Mr. Rooney on that one. But I appreciate it, man. No, I'm just kidding. You know, some of these listeners may take offense to that. But that was the real reason. I wasn't cheering against you by any means. But I was always wondering myself, would those captains give me a ring since I played 10 games that year? But then I was like, well, did I really earn it? So I was like second guessing myself. Mm-hmm. And I was a little jealous. I couldn't lie because I'd lived that and I wanted to go to three. But whatever, that's old news. But you were talking about playing football at home, man. I always wanted to play in a Panthers uniform, not because they are better than the Steelers as a team or organization, because Pittsburgh's top-notch organization, but because it's home. And I just think it's cool that when we actually played in Charlotte, when I was on Pittsburgh, there were so many three jerseys and Reed jerseys, and I think it was more because they were my friends and who I grew up with and stuff in Charlotte. So what was it like playing at home?
It was different. I was excited because I did have an opportunity to come home. I didn't know how long that was going to be. But for me, when I put that uniform on for the first time, that was so real. Because I'm looking back, I'm like, wow, this is, you know, something that I watched, grew up watching it all the way through. And I know it was a preseason game, but that was special to me when I was just standing in that locker room and having the opportunity to put it on. But it was good and bad. Good part was I was home, spent holidays home. I was just literally 10 minutes down the road from where we practiced that. Now, on the flip side, the bad part was
tickets.
Tickets. They were ridiculous.
I knew it.
Ridiculous, because everyone is sitting back, and if they think you get tickets for free, they're like, hey, you know, give me 20. Yeah, that's all you knew with 20.
Sure. The Steelers, we got plenty of seats.
So you do have, you lose some your friends, and then after a while, you kind of do, damn, were they really my friends? Yeah, they're mad because I didn't get them tickets. But that was the downside. And I said, if that was a negative part of being home, I could take it, because I told my mom, hey, you're responsible for tickets. You just get the request, and hopefully we can go out there and feel it. But it was always tough because during those years we were successful, and regardless if we bought tickets or not, guess what? That stadium was going to be filled. And that was something that I was able to get past the very first time. But, of course, you go to that first Super Bowl as we all go through it together. That was the first one, so it was exciting to go through. And, of course, that was a nice hefty bill trying to get everybody there. And but it was exciting, especially whenever you won it. But that, I mean, being home and being able to be part of it, man, it was truly special to be able to do so and be that close to home.
Yeah, I could imagine. You know, I had a feeling you'd say tickets, because obviously just with the friends you meet, I've met here in Pittsburgh, it became like, just because you were boys or you had a drink with them, mm-hmm. they expect you. Then if you do get them tickets, because you tell them maybe one game, yeah, I'll do it for you. Then they don't want to pay you because they think they're free. So that runs into a different problem.
That's where I had my mom.
Well, you're smart.
She took care of the list, and then she would go down the list every single week, and she would say,
if you didn't pay,
hey, who do you want me to charge? I say, everybody. Like, don't tell me who to charge and be selective on that way. But when somebody, and I've learned, when somebody has a financial obligation to a ticket, they're more prone to go.
Right.
Versus saying, yeah, on Tuesday, I want to go to the game, but then they see the weather report and they realize it's going to rain all day Sunday, or it's going to be freezing outside. Then they change their mind and they don't want tickets
anymore.
And
then you're wasting your money.
Correct. Yeah. So, you know, that was something that I've learned, and I try to pass that along to make sure they have somebody designated to be their ticket person.
I sure wish I'd have had that thought process. I was too busy trying to be nice to people, and then they took advantage of me. And pretty much 90% of those people are not in my life, so, which is probably a good thing because they were in it for the wrong reason. But so you played 15 seasons in the NFL. You were drafted in the second round of 1998. God, that seems like so long ago.
I know, right?
Damn, Charlie, you're
old.
You
should see every Thanksgiving, all the rookies would always come up to me because they would go home and watch the game, and they didn't realize I was on Detroit. And they were like, you played with Barry Sanders? Oh, heck nah. Yeah. And I had the bald head going on, and that's how I realized how old I was, as though rookies didn't even remember that.
You know, it's funny you brought that up, because that was my predetermined answer for your own question. I was going to say, out of all the years you played in the NFL, And I mean, you played with some good guys at Eastern Michigan as well. Who is the best player you ever played with as an athlete? Doesn't have to be the best person.
Yeah, I mean, I had the opportunity to play with a lot of different people. I mean, I was so young when I played with Barry Sanders. That was his 10th year in the league. That was my first. I thought I would play with him for at least three more years. And then when I came to Pittsburgh, they sit me next to Jerome Bettis's locker, and I'm sitting there looking at this guy, and I'm like, wow, I remember watching him when I was in high school, you know, or I was in college at that point, watching him in college, and I'm sitting next to the guy. So I didn't want to be a fan, you know. I'm like, nah, yeah. Hey, Jerome, how you doing? Yeah. You know,
I was starstruck, man, when I got here.
And then I'm just like, hey, dude, I need you to sign my jersey, man. And he just kind of looked at me like, for real? And I'm like, yeah, I'm dead serious, because I need you to sign my jersey, because when I was in Detroit, I thought I was going to play with Barry Sanders for a while, and he retired on me. And it took me a while to get my jerseys from him. So I need to get my jersey right here. And then, I won't hang it up right away until we're both done playing. I said, but at least I have an opportunity to get that jersey signed. But when you talk about the person who I really admired was Jerome, because a lot of things that he was doing in the community, I wanted to do. He won NFL Man of the Year.
And you are doing it.
And that was something that you try to emulate and try to pick a little bit from someone, and kind of as you kind of create their own niche for yourself. That's who I watch. Even though I was so close yet so far away in years, it was somebody that I was able to pick his brain a lot and really literally learn what he was doing in the community.
Speaking of winning that award, yeah, JB, man, hopefully I'll get you on here too, man. That'd be a hell of a thing for me. But 2012, you were the NFL Man of the Year, I think, if I looked that up correctly.
Yeah, the Byron Rizzer White.
What does that mean?
That's the Players Association Man of the Year. The NFL has
that was political. They just liked you? You didn't really do anything?
Well, I hope so. But the NFL has their Man of the Year. Then the Players Association has their Man of the Year. Actually, Jason Witten won the NFL Man of the Year, Walter Payton Man of the Year, and the Players Association called the Byron Rizzer White. They named it after Supreme Court Justice, and I was the Man of the Year. And when you win that, and you have 1,900 players
that
you choose from, and they selected all the way down, and my name was chosen, I was surprised, because I was in awe. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. You know, here, a guy that literally is trying to just do something good, and you recognize that. It's just, you know, it was humbling for me to be able to literally have an opportunity to represent the Players Association and stand up as Man of the Year.
Yeah, that's very commendable. Of course, I look up your bio, and you know, I can go through stats, but anybody can look that up. But a couple things jumped out, and that was one of them, because to be the NFL Man of the Year, I think I'd rather be that than go to the Pro Bowl, because that means you're impacting other people's lives, and it's not just a personal achievement. And I really commend you on that. Now, as far as your position at quarterback, I hear so many people, and I'm on Sports Talk in Charlotte, and it's kind of funny because I always say, God, the media's annoying as hell, and now I'm part of it. So it's kind of so I can be annoying as hell. But I'm part of it in a more of a not a stats critical way. Just what I say, like down in Charlotte, they get pissed because I say the Panthers were going to be 6-10 before the season started. Well, it's starting to come to fruition.
Right.
But they're not okay with that because they're homers and they want them to be 16-0. Well, everybody wants to win every game.
Right.
But see, if you're a realist and they get pissed, then so I create all kind of controversy. So people call in and talk about Derek Anderson, and he's a hell of a backup quarterback. And I think people don't have an appreciation. They call you guys that were backups, and once you lost your starting role or accepted your role, however you want to look at it, he's the best clipboard holder. Can you explain the importance of a backup quarterback on a game day?
Well, it really starts before game day, because you're practicing all week without getting any reps with the starters. So people tend to take it for granted when they see you prepare. So you're going through preparing as if you're the other quarterback all week. Then you're trying to know the game plan better than what the starting quarterback would, because you just don't know if you're going to be called upon that week. So you're practicing. No physical reps, mental reps that you're getting throughout the course of the week. Then as you get closer to the game, now you're just standing there watching. And for me, standing behind Ben Roethlisberger for so many years, it seemed like, you know, he may get nicked every game.
Right.
So you don't know which one is real. So he's laying on the ground. He's getting up. I'm grabbing my helmet. I'm warming up. He's like, no, Chuck, I'm okay. All right, I sit back down. Then you stand there again, and you're just kind of watching differently. So not only are you paying attention to the game, but you're paying attention to him getting up every single time. And guess what? The game could go by, and you never get in the game.
Right.
So then all of a sudden, the coach is congratulating everyone at the door. Good game, good game, good game. And then I'm standing there. He gets to me, says, good game. And I'm like, well, coach, I didn't really do much today. You're thinking me, I'm in a good game. You know, you kind of feel like, wow, you're playing this game called football, but I didn't get in today. So, you know, everybody else is going through it. So you are preparing for that moment. And when is that moment going to happen? You don't know. It can happen in week number 12. The starter goes down. All of a sudden, you're in the middle of the fourth quarter, sat for 3 hours, and they tell you to go in there and complete a 3rd and 10.
Yeah.
People just don't get it. And that's why it takes a while for guys to get going, because number one, the offensive coordinators, they kind of they clamp everything down because they want to make sure, okay, you have to get up to speed with the rest of the team because they've been playing for the length of the game.
Right.
And they want to make sure that you're not going to put yourself in a position where you're hurting the team. So it's just, it's a tough situation because you battle yourself mentally all the way through. I know I said a bunch, but quarterbacks who actually have been in this position understand what I'm talking about. And to be able to last the way that I was able to do for 11 years that way, people just think, like you said, you're a clipboard holder. You don't do anything else. Like, no, you still have to prove you belong on that team. And the coach has to trust you, not only the coach, but the players, knowing that if you were to get involved in that particular situation, that you will be able to get the job done. And that was something that I prided myself on every single preseason, because I knew those guys were watching me and they had to go out there and believe that I can get it done.
Yeah, I believe people have the perception, and usually the biggest critics are the ones that have never put a jock strap on or played a sport, mm-hmm. because they like talking shit about it, but they don't even realize that if they were on that field, how lost they would look or be. But as far, obviously everybody knows your quarterback skill. Were you a stud in your own eyes, or maybe in high school you were a standout at a different position?
Well, for me it was always quarterback. I know you saw my speed, Jeff. I mean, yeah, I'm 4'3" guy.
Yeah, I think I was faster than you.
Yeah, I was 4'3", 30.
When it came, yeah, I was about a 4'3", 20, 25.
So those are things that, you know, for me, it was like we always had fast guys. I was the one who could throw the ball the furthest. And they said, Charlie, you want to know what? You're just going to be the quarterback. And regardless of what it was, if it was playing actually on the football field or you're playing pickup ball, I would seem like I was always the steady quarterback because I can complete the most passes. But when you're, you know, doing that throughout the entire time, I played quarterback the entire time all the way through. And obviously had to kind of create that niche to a certain degree to make sure I was able to be sharp mentally to be able to anticipate what I was going to do with the ball, because I knew there wasn't a lot of times that I couldn't evade the pass rush.
Right.
I need to get the ball out of my hand, and I was able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I know, and I mean, I can't put myself in your shoes because I don't have the ability to throw like you or to probably even understand a playbook. I had 5 plays, and I didn't really know them as a kicker. They're all fakes. But I could imagine the trust you have to have in those guys blocking for you, and the timing and the routes and everything, because the athletes are in such phenomenal shape, and you just have to sit back there and you can absolutely get obliterated, or you can take one step and avoid a concussion.
Right. One of the things that people don't realize is when you break training camp, you only have 5, maybe 6 receivers, a 7th if they add one to the practice squad. And the issue is the starter takes the reps, so he's running routes with the starter. So he might take the first 4 receivers. I get a throw. The 13 quarterback gets a throw. And that's all you get for today. Guess what? The period starts, and Ben is throwing to all of those starters. So you got to almost anticipate what those guys are going to do without getting those reps. And it's tough to do, because if you're a split second off, guess what? It's either incomplete pass. It could possibly be an interception.
Right.
But you have to be able to step in, and you never want to give the coaches an opportunity to say he wasn't ready, he wasn't prepared. But that's something that I prided myself on, to be able to say, you want to know what? I can watch guys and how they run their routes, and if I had to step in and complete a pass, I could do so.
Yeah, that's right, man. And you did it damn well. And I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about, you know, just life things and a couple funny things, and mix it up a little bit. I know you're currently working, it says, KDKA TV in Pittsburgh. You do that, pregame analyst for the Steelers, as well as with Champ Sports Network as a color analyst for Whippeels. So that's pretty cool. That's football and basketball, correct?
Yes, football and basketball.
And do you know anything about basketball, or you think you do?
No, I do. I was a star.
I'm on the air, they talk about the Hornets, I just start throwing out names like I'm really smart. No idea what I'm talking about.
But I played basketball in high school all the way up. I played intramurals in college, but obviously I knew that was not going to take me anywhere.
Right.
But I love basketball more than I do football. And having an opportunity to go out and commentate some of these high school games. I mean, you're seeing and you're bringing, you know, some notoriety to their game. You're showing up. It's important for them because they want to look through the crowd and say, yeah, look at Charlie Batch. He's over here. He's at my game. You know, so yeah. it's just fun to be able to do, especially, you know, package it all together so they can go out there and listen to it after the game is over. And it's always fun. And regardless of what it may be, I do. Now, you talked about high school basketball, but I actually do high school football too. I commentate on Friday night. So every Friday night, we actually go out, regardless if it's quad A all the way down to the lowest level here, single A, to make sure that we package things together with Comcast as well. We can bundle it up. Kids can always go back and watch it on demand. So we're trying to bring some notoriety to the school and to the players because they appreciate it. And being part of the WPIL at a younger age, and I know how important it is for these guys to go out there and do their thing and have fun, and I just love watching them compete. So it's not bad at all, you know, and this is something that we've teamed up with the WPIL probably about 3 years ago, and they had an issue within their organization with a couple schools. They asked me to be part of it and create a program for the kids, and actually two communities ended up getting to a fight at a basketball game. And when I say get into a fight, you have basically one predominantly white school, predominantly black school playing basketball. And in the student section at the white school, they would always dress up in costumes.
I think, was that here?
Yeah, it was Brentwood and Manassas.
I think I saw that on National News.
It was National News. It definitely made it. And the student section didn't think anything of it, but that in that particular day, they dressed up in a banana. So Manassas took offense to that, and they thought that they were making fun of them.
Right.
So they got into a big brawl. So at the end of it, they're like, wait, we didn't do this. You know, this is something that we've done all the time. We didn't do it purposely. And they wanted to really rectify everything. So communities felt some tight way. So I brought all the kids together, and we were sitting up at the WPIO offices, and they said, Charlie, can you just help? Can you help create a program? And what we did over those weeks, we created a dignity and respect program. And basically what it comes down to is it's a simple, one simple pledge. It says I will treat everyone with dignity and respect. And at that point, each school had an assembly and they both participated in it. So they came, showed support. And then on the flip side, when football season came on the other side. So the first one was at Brentwood. The first one was at Manassas. The second one was at Brentwood. And then what they did was bring both schools together. They actually made everyone in the everyone in the stands sign a pledge. They did dignity and respect pledge. Both bands played together, and it was just something to bring everyone back together. And it was great to be able to do so. So what we did was continue that on. And instead of having rivalry games, we just called them games of tradition. So we tried to take some of the stigma out of it. That's a negative thing, and tried to make it positive. And we've been able to incorporate this all through the WPIL. And it's been phenomenal because we touched over 10,000 students.
That's good, man. I didn't know that. I actually did see that on National News, that story of the, you know, created all these racist comments and, you know, speculation, which, you know, I could easily see as how they took it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Easily. Mm-hmm. I mean, bad choice of fruit that day.
Yes,
I guess.
Exactly. and they show proof. They show proof every game where they showed up in a particular costume. Right, wrong, or indifferent, that's what they did. So now that light has been shined on that, now they just say, you know what, we're not going to do that anymore because somebody might take offense to that, or they may check in with the administration on the other side in the school to make sure that they don't take offense to it.
Well, that's good that you got them back on their feet, man, because, you know, it's so important as a professional athlete or celebrity, however, whatever you do, I've been in trouble before, but stay out of trouble and help others, because we all know that it's very easy to go down the wrong path. And but I wanted to talk about something else, because I think your insight on this or your story of this could be really cool. Years ago, obviously we know in 2006, Ben got in a motorcycle wreck. Mm-hmm. You were one of the very few people that got to visit him in his hospital room. Is that correct?
Yeah,
or am I making
correct.
That up?
Yes.
Okay, and I remember asking you, and you told me, because I was concerned about him, obviously. I mean, he was supposed to be our leader. He's our leader. And what was going through your mind what did he look like?
Yeah, it was
Because it's
was
hard
tough.
For us to imagine, you know, all the negative things they said that he looked like. We can't really imagine.
Right.
That.
When it first happened, I remember sitting at home, and I remember getting a phone call from James Harrison. And he says, Charlie, he said, did Ben get into an accident? I'm like, nah. I said, I'm sitting in front of the TV. Nothing popped up. There's no breaking news or anything. So I was clicking through the three stations. Nothing came up. So I'm trying to make phone calls, and I'm trying to, nobody's answering their phone. Nobody's knows. Well, you want to know what? So I called James back. I said, where did it happen at? He said, well, it happened right down there on 10th Street. He said, they said he took him to Mercy Hospital. So after maybe another 20 so minutes, I'm still trying to figure out what's going on. And then they broke the news and they said, hey, possible motorcycle accident. And they just showed the motorcycle. And then at that point, I'm like, okay, I need to go down to this hospital and figure out what's going on. So I ended up walking into the hospital, or walking towards the hospital. And of course, at this time now, all media and local media is standing outside of the hotel hospital, and they're reporting on everything else, so they're asking for comment as you walk in. I didn't have any comment. I'm trying to figure out what's going on myself. Right. Finally get in there. He's in surgery. Had no idea how long it was going to be. Talking to his family, and we're sitting there, and the doctor comes back out and he says, well, he's probably going to be another 2 or 3 hours in surgery. And it might be 6 or 7 o'clock, the earliest that you'll be able to at least see. So I ended up leaving. Still had no idea what was going on. Didn't talk to a reporter walking out. I ended up coming back down about 9 o'clock, 8:30, 9 o'clock. He was in recovery. Didn't get a chance to see him because they were only allowing intermediate family in there. So, but they did allow Mr. Rooney to walk in to see him. And they ended up coming out and they said, you're not going to be able to see him tonight. You have to come back the following day. So I ended up going back down there the following day. His mom was there, sister, his dad, and we're sitting back there, and I'm like, hey, can I see him? And they're like, yeah, you know, let me make sure he's okay. So I ended up walking back, and they pulled the curtain back when I walked in, and I didn't recognize him. And I'm looking at him like, wow, this is a completely different guy. You know, we sat back, and he was conscious because he was, you know, we were having a little bit of conversation, and, you know, I'm asking him how he's doing. He's like, he's fine. And I'm just looking at him. I'm like, this is not the same guy. You know, I'm wondering how much surgery that they actually did on him. And still sitting there talking to him, probably spent at least an hour or so, you know, in there. And he shows me the pictures of what happened. And I'm looking at the car. I'm looking at the motorcycle. And then I keep looking up and I'm like, you're still here? You know, like this is crazy. And he's trying to explain what's going on. I'm just kind of listening to him. And then afterward, you know, he kind of falls back to sleep. So as he sleep, I said, how's everything? He's like, he's probably going to be back to sleep for a while because he was still taking his pain medication. And, you know, from there, you know, I ended up leaving. He got released a day or so later. And it was just the fact that even to this day, Ben doesn't remember the conversations that we had. And I'm like, hey, you remember the conversation? He's like, I don't remember. You know, and I'm just like, wow, you know, and just battling through that. And of course, you know, everyone in Pittsburgh or, you know, around the country, Steeler Nation was concerned about him playing football again. And I'm standing there like, who gives a damn about playing football? Is he going to be okay? Yeah. I mean, I could care. I mean, what about training camp? I don't care about that. You know, so now in one sense, I'm preparing because I may have to lead this team at the beginning, because you don't know how long he's out as he continues to recover, and you can see him turning for the best right around 4th of July, because that's whenever the ESPYs was happening. He ended up going out to, I think it was L.A., and he actually walked on stage for the first time, and that's when people got a chance to see him, and they just like, wow. And you just look at his face, it just doesn't look the same as it did back then. And I was just glad that he's still here. And regardless of how football was, he never missed training camp. He went out there and took every single practice, every single play. And, you know, from there, it just, you know, got to that point of saying, okay, you're going to be ready to play. And then next thing you know, he has an emergency appendectomy. And here I am starting the opening game,
yep.
You know, of the season opener coming off the Super Bowl against Miami.
Yeah, that's crazy, because you didn't ever tell me that in depth, but you told me, and I was just trying to put myself in your shoes, like, what the hell would I have thought if you basically saw someone that you considered a good friend and teammate that was basically dead in front mm-hmm. of you? And I mean, I've seen my mother sick and in a hospital and things like that, and I've seen, obviously, open caskets and stuff that aren't cool, but, you know, when you told me that, I thought it was important to say it on this podcast, because that's something that I'll never forget, mm-hmm. you know, because that's how quickly life can change.
And one of the things that people always remember, they always remember those TV satellite trucks all up and down in front of the hospital, and you couldn't even move because it was so crowded, and everyone was concerned, rightfully so, about him, and they were trying to get a glimpse of what he looked like. And of course, they, you know, they're going to slide him out the back door, and right. He walks out of there. But it was just something that, you know, that day I'll never forget, because even at that point, he was actually getting ready to film a Campbell Soup commercial. And everyone from Campbell's headquarters were all flying into town, and they had no idea that he got into a motorcycle accident because they were still in the air. That's, you didn't have internet on the plane, so they couldn't follow it as everything right. was going through. But they didn't find out until they landed. Well, of course, now they have all set up, ready to go. They don't have their star to run this commercial. So right. what they did was actually use a bunch of people who they thought were close, and they brought them all into Pittsburgh. And, of course, I got a role in the Campbell Soup commercial. And we were filming all the way through. We filmed for 3 days, I think it was. And we filmed for 3 days for a 30-second commercial. And we're just sitting
there. Well, I remember doing that McDonald's commercial with you. Right, and you had that tough line, man.
Yeah, I'm sitting up there looking. I'm like, but, you know, when you win the Super Bowl, commercials are coming out. And
oh, yeah. It was cool, man.
We had fun times. And, I mean, I know, you know, Ben was mentioned, you know, doing that commercial. But that's how we ended up into that Campbell Soup commercial that year.
And, I didn't think about that.
And there were probably five or six of us, and we ate as much soup that I probably will ever eat again. And you just hate it, you know, because it's, every cut is cut, you know, you're already ready, and everybody eats the soup, and you're sitting back, and the soup has to be perfect. It can't be a line. You can't shake it. You know, you shake the bowl.
Well, that's how they kept painting the Big Mac in the McDonald's commercial. They kept painting the sauce on there, so it dripped down just right.
Kind of look, I'm like, oh, okay. You know, but, you know, you see a different light. You know, you see it different because you get a chance behind the glimpse, behind the scenes look of how they do the actual commercials. And you talk about that commercial, that McDonald's commercial, man.
You had the toughest line, man.
People still look at that, man. They sit back.
I watched it the other day. I told Nate to put it on my website. I was like, man, I can't believe I was in a McDonald's commercial.
It was something I remember because I had to practice. It was, you know, extra value.
It was premium,
crispy chicken but you extra had to value meal. Yeah,
premium chicken, extra value. Saying premium chicken, and I was like, tough, "Come on, man! I got a helmet on. I'm eating these cold ass fries,
right,
come on, Charlie?
Right? It was tough, man. It was fun going through, man. But you know, it was the way that they set up the commercial, man, and they saw you set up. I mean, your form was perfect.
Yeah,
and you came through. Follow through was great.
And we beat them by an extra point. That was good. That was about 6 hours, and that's a 30-second
commercial,
too.
Yeah, that was about six. That was
unbelievable.
Crazy.
No, we got a little sidetracked with those stories, but I thought those were important. But going back, obviously we've talked about this. 15 years professional sports, and obviously numerous years before that. How did you – I mean, I didn't dig extremely deep, but how did you stay out of trouble? And how many bullets did you really dodge? Because it just seems like – in 15 years, I mean, things can happen today, but 15 years, that's a long time to stay out of the news in a bad way.
Yeah, I think for me, I was home. And when you have an opportunity to come home, I guess you just grow up at some point. And for me, it was just, realizing, okay, what do I want to do? I mean, I don't know.
Did you
know.
Never get pissed at a paper towel dispenser or anything?
No, unfortunately, I didn't.
Why? Those things are annoying.
Yeah.
Did you ever get like your chips caught in those little machines, the snack machines?
You didn't ever shake it.
Yeah, you should have got arrested for that.
Yeah, it's almost like tilting a pinball machine, you know? But you're so upset with it. But I had, honestly, man, it was just something that, just being home. I mean, I could just say because I was so familiar with everything. I just
probably knew a lot of people too. Yeah. If something was going down, you could probably get the right police officer or something.
Yeah, you know,
that always helps.
Everything wasn't crispy clean, but you know,
that's good though, man. I'm impressed because I mean, it's so easy to not really go down the wrong path, but you're human, so you're gonna make mistakes.
Right.
I mean, we do them every day, but I don't know. I never saw myself getting arrested for sticking up for a teammate that was going in the restroom in the middle of the parking lot. But, you know, the thing that hurt me more about that was not the bad publicity because I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. But it was a police officer slamming the door on my mother that really pissed me off. And I couldn't really act the way I wanted to because I know I would have got, you know, I would have got my ass kicked and really locked up, which I was never arrested. But, you know, those things, you know, happen every day, and the situations presented are so tough too.
But you know how this. I mean, it's new, so news driven at this point. Everyone right. wants to be the first to break the story, regardless if it's right or wrong.
Right.
It's the fact of having their name attached to maybe a breaking story, and unfortunately, the way that this society is, they don't necessarily allow you to tell your story because they automatically say that you're guilty before proven innocent, which is unfortunate because we don't get our time
right.
in court before public perception.
Yeah, I mean, then your opinion really doesn't matter when it comes to that. Absolutely. So, I mean, then people come to their perceptions of you, and then automatically that, oh, I hate Jeff Reed. Well, that's good. Well, I didn't need you in my life anyway. That's how I look at it. But as far as your health, man, I know you had a lot of injuries. You fought through a lot. Sometimes they kept you out with your shoulder injuries, things like that. How do you feel?
Well, it depends.
I mean, because I have my opinion on how I feel. Right. I'm 35.
Well, now I'm fine because the weather is 60 degrees outside. But when that weather starts changing and I wake up, I'm like, man, y'all, the joints are going and they're tough. And, you know, it's just, you know, I've had my share of injuries. I've had six surgeries, and that was something that when you're battling that, of course, arthritis is going to kick in at some point down the line, and it's already starting to kick in for me now in some spots. But I had a great massage therapist who actually was able to help rehab me and get me through all of my surgeries. And without her, I probably wouldn't have lasted as long as I did, because she's more than just a massage therapist. I mean, she literally is one of those ones that is, you know, there's a little ART attached to it and all those things that people are now doing and specializing. She was doing that at a very early age that she was able to help me get through. And without, a lot of players use her and they know the value that she brings with her. But I was fortunate enough to only be in two cities, which is Detroit, where she lives, and come to Pittsburgh, which is driving distance for her to come in and continue to do what she's doing every week.
Yeah, I don't think I don't think the average person understands what it takes to keep your body in enough shape to not just lifting weights and running.
Right.
Obviously, that's important. But what it, and I'm having James Harrison as one of my guests too. And when I do, it'll be he spends some crazy amount of money.
Mm-hmm. And people look at him like he's crazy.
Acupuncture and everything. Yeah. But that's the only thing that keeps him going. Mm-hmm. Because I know I couldn't imagine being hit that many times. And.
And I think about it, you have to, when you play that game on Sunday, you have to get your body ready to go after 70 some plays that you have to 48 hours be ready to practice on Wednesday.
Right.
And people don't look at it that way because they're already focusing on the next game. They're not worried about the preparation.
You have an entire week.
Yeah, they're not worried about the preparation to go through and what it takes to get to that next game. And in some cases, it might be Thursday night. So just imagine if you're having a hard time from Sunday to Sunday, just imagine what that Sunday through Thursday feels like.
I mean, I was extremely sore, and a lot of it was the adrenaline rush, and obviously kicking is not the most normal motion out there, but I wasn't getting hit every play either, and I couldn't imagine how their bodies feel. But they also don't have it all upstairs, speaking about James. But that's a different story. That's for him. But you have a million things going for you right now, and you always have since I've known you for, what, probably 12 years or so?
Going on, yeah.
But if you were handed when you leave the man cave today, if you were just handed your ideal job, what would you want to do today? Unless you're already doing it,
right? I'm not actually doing it. My ideal job would be general manager for the Pittsburgh Steelers. So I want to take Kevin Colbert's job.
Well, I can help you with that.
That would be ideal. You know, be right down the street doing what he's doing, Pittsburgh guy,
and you're a business guy,
and being able to run the organization the way that he is. I mean, I've known him for 16 years now. He actually drafted me when I was in Detroit. That's how far we go
back.
That's right.
He was.
So get a chance to know him and see what he's doing. I mean, it's phenomenal. But that would be the dream job, you know. But for me right now, you know, I love the role that I have. And with the last collective bargaining agreement, there was money that was allocated that we negotiated away from the owners, which was to help players transition away from the game. Whatever facet, business, it could be financial, career, education, lifestyle, whatever it looks like for you, and you tailor it down. So we were able to allocate money, which is $22 million away from the owners every single year. So you're talking the length of the deal. So for the next 10 years, you're talking over $200 million that could be allocated to help players transition away from the game. 2 years up to 15 years out. And at that point, you have an opportunity just to reach guys where they're at. Because for so long, there was nothing. When you exited the league, you just were with a closed door. Good luck with the rest of your life. That's basically what you receive when you were out. But we knew that players wanted to do other things. How can we help players do other things? So as my role as senior captain is an outreach to make sure that I let guys know that there are other things out there. If you want to go back to school, guess what? The trust is here to help you pay for school. If you want to go back and start your own business, guess what? The trust is here to be able to help you do that. So they assign you a program manager to help to see what that looks like for you. In a lot of cases, brain and body can be one of them. You know, you just want to go through and make sure that you're examining your body, have a second opinion when it comes to different doctors to see what they want to do, how they're going to evaluate you. Maybe it helps with your workers' comp. Maybe it doesn't. I don't know. But either way, it's the best benefit of that particular player. And guess what? It's all free, and you can actually enroll and do that. So if you want to take advantage of it, or anybody out there wants to take advantage of it, my role is to outreach and let players know this is here for them. But the unfortunate part is there's 16,000 former players.
Right.
It's hard to reach every single person,
of course,
by an email, by a phone. So you're hoping that as you now outreach and those, and everyone gets to it, that they want to enroll in it. So it's just a little bit more time. And it actually just 1 year, basically to this day, that it just started out, and over 500 players have had the opportunity to take advantage of something or one service that the trust offers.
That's cool, man. And you know, but your ideal job, that's very reachable too. I mean, a lot of people's ideal jobs probably won't happen, because that's they, I mean you think about it, you ask a 40-year-old sometimes, and they're already a CEO of a company, but their ideal job is to be a professional athlete. Well, probably that's not going to happen. Right. But yours is very reachable, so and you're the right person for it too. I mean, I think the guys would really respect you. They already do. And the only thing that would suck about that is when you had to let people go.
Yeah, that's the toughest part.
But that's the business.
That's
and,
the business.
Unfortunately,
of it.
We were both part of that. But
no matter what, every person will be part of that former club. At some point, either your contract's going
to
expire, or nobody else offers you a deal at the end of it, or they're going to come tap you on the shoulder and they're going to say, "Hey,
thank you for your services.
Thank you for your services. You continue on with your journey."
Yeah, a couple of personal questions, and I want to talk a little charity work, and then I'll get to the extra points segment, and we'll end it up. But who or what is your inspiration? I know you're real tight with your mother. Your mother's great. I've known her for a long time through your events and playing with you. But who or what is your inspiration?
Actually, my mother is. And I know you just touched on that, but I didn't grow up with a father. And she was my mother and father. And at times, she, you know, I looked at her as my hero, because when you are that young and looking back and seeing everything that she was able to do and really had and not allow us to think that we were in need of anything, that was impressive to watch. And she worked two, maybe sometimes three jobs to be able to put us through, and especially when they're playing sports, it's not cheap to be able to do so. But she made sure that we were able to go out there and do what we want to do, and our passion was to play sports, but at the same time stayed on us to make sure that we were able to stay in our books just as hard as we were putting the work on the field as well. So she made sure that she understood the business, the sports and education go hand in hand, and that was something that was important that she instilled in us a long time ago.
Yeah, I had a feeling you'd say that, but I mean, that's the only person in your family that I truly knew, not just met, and she's a great lady, so I can see where that's coming from. We, throughout this whole podcast so far, Charlie has touched on his what he does with charity and how many lives basically he's touched, and I'm sure he's left out 90% of it, but I did look up a couple things, and you were the 2006 recipient of the Jerome Bettis Award, which is obviously cool for you, and that's the Humanity and Community Service, and for your work in supporting children, and obviously that goes hand-in-hand with the Best of the Batch Foundation. You had another prize, I don't even know how to pronounce it, Scram McCracken? What is that?
Scram McCracken?
What is that?
I don't know, you tell
prize me. Prize 2002. I don't know.
Oh, that was a while ago, yeah.
Yeah, that was me.
Award I got, yeah.
That was me supposed to ask you, what the hell is that? Or did you just give yourself that?
I think
in your
that
Wikipedia?
Was it. I think that. No, I don't even do the Wikipedia, so I don't even know who does that.
Yeah, well,
so I know I wouldn't put that. That's not on my bio.
Yeah, that's on there.
On my professional bio, not the Wikipedia. Professional
oh, no, no,
bio.
No. That's
correct.
On. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't control the Wikipedia. I don't even know how to do that. So wherever they get their information on the Wikipedia,
yeah, there's something on there with me too. It's actually true, but I'm like,
and the crazy part
that
is they updated, and yeah. I'm like, who did that?
Yeah.
But I know it wasn't me.
Okay, well, whatever. You won that prize too. So if you win a prize, it's usually a good thing. But with your charity idea, did you come up with that because you like children that much, or based on off of your childhood, that's what you wanted to focus on?
Actually, it was something that started for me February 18th, 1996. And I remember being in college. And at that point, I remember receiving a phone call from my mother. And she told me I needed to come home. You know, and at that point, I'm like, Mom, why do I need to come home? And she just said, you just pack your bag and come home. But, you know, back then, you didn't have cell phones. So I'm getting on this road. I'm like, Mom, you need to tell me why I'm coming home. And at that point, she told me, she said, your sister's been shot and killed. And I'm like, what do you mean my sister's been shot and killed? And she said, just get home. So, you know, I make this drive 5 hours from Detroit to Pittsburgh. And I get to Homestead. But when you come across that bridge, the waterfront wasn't there now.
Right.
You know, the old steel mills was all shut down. And finally get home and, you know, you knew something happened. But my mom is preparing for the funeral, so I didn't get a chance to see my sister. You're hearing stories of what happened and what not. And basically the story goes like this. My sister was walking down the street from her friend's house. She got caught in crossfire between rival gangs. And the guy that she was walking with used her as a body shield. Danielle was 17 years old. She never had an opportunity to live life. And at that point, I said, if I was ever in position to give back, I would. And at that point, I wanted to do something in my family that's never been done. That was to graduate college. So I put all my time and energy to graduate from college. And then at that point, hopefully put myself in position that one of the 32 teams would draft me. And I was blessed to be able to do that with the Detroit Lions in 1998. And then at that point in 99, I started my foundation. And we started to do some programming in Detroit. And then when I got here in 2002, I redirected my foundation goals back to Pittsburgh. And I was trying to figure out how to get boys and girls involved, get them off the street and involved in programming. And the easy way for me to do that was through basketball. And I was able to get 125 kids, 25 volunteers all out for 5 weeks during that time, 4 days a week, 3 days a week during that time. And every year they continued to grow. So not only did the kids in numbers grow, but the volunteers grew. And 1 year turned into two, two turned into three, three turned into eight, and eight turned in now to 13 years. And here we are 13 years later with just that one particular program. And that one program touches 363 kids 8 weeks now. I would do it for 8 weeks, 4 days a week. And now it's our way of now getting kids off the street, but at the same time making them focus on their education, because every kid that goes through, they have to attend three mandatory study sessions and they need to read a book in order to play. So it's our way of making sure that the kids are still focusing on education right along during the summer with the sports. But that was the way to be able to do it. And whenever you keep adding programming and meeting partners and your network and those sponsors turn into partners because they understand what you're doing, it allowed us to continue to grow it. And now that we're over 3,100 kids annually, five different counties, 13 different programs, it's special because here we have an actual office space. You know, we have alternative school program that's taught in our building daily, middle school and high school. People don't know that. But when you do that for the last 7 years, the money that we raise for this event that you'll be participating in, this raises money for our reading computer literacy programs. So when you have a computer lab that these kids can go to, we don't have Boys and Girls Club. We're the closest thing to this, to a Boys and Girls Club or a YMCA. This is our way of continue to grow. And when you're able to do that, it's just special because, you know, we're humbled because people are supporting everything that we're doing. But it started with a vision 18 years ago. And 18 years ago, that vision, now here we are continuing to build. And there are a lot of people won't know the story because those kids weren't born during that time. But the parents and the families, they know the story of what we were doing during that time. And we were struggling because we were that top story in the news when it came down to, you know, senseless violence that was going on these streets. So we're just trying to do our small part to continue to hopefully take back our community, to be able to show, look, we can do something. And when you have and you add great partners in here on top of it, it allows you to grow. And that's how I've been able to do it. And I don't do it by myself. We have over 100 volunteers that help out and help us do it every single day. And, you know, it's a grind. You know, when you have kids running through the building, sometimes you may not sleep well the night before, but you're tired walking in the building. Next thing you know, you have a building full of kids coming in and out of there. And you know what? I got to put this smile on. And, you know, you don't get a lot of thank yous when you're doing this, but when you see the smiles on the kids' faces, that's the reminders of the thanks you get. Absolutely. So that's how we've been able to do it over the course of the last now 14 years, whenever we're, with our program. But it's just exciting. And I knew when I was playing what I wanted to do when I was done. Foundation was going to be nonprofit work, was something that I was going to be involved with. And I used that platform when I was playing to be able to help me transition and make it smoother.
Well, that's good, man. That's a very touching story, by the way. We're joking around and being serious, and then you hear something like that, man. I'm over here choked up. I'm glad I wasn't talking. But, you know, I was going to ask you, all things can always improve. What are your long-term visions for Best of the Batch? But you pretty much just said it. So,
but no. Actually, we are in the process. We are in the process of building a state-of-the-art educational facility. Okay. So you'll see we're unveiling it tonight. So you'll be able to see what that building will look like.
Cool.
And it will be a two-year project, and we're going to expand on where our offices are currently located at. So,
where is that building going
to
be?
We're right in Munn Hall. We're literally right next to the Munn Hall Borough Building, and that's where our offices are at. So we're going to expand. We're going to take half of the block. And it's just something that, it's exciting for us because with the Byron Wizard White Award that I won, there was a monetary amount that was attached to that. And it was $100,000 that I won. And it was able, it allowed us to kickstart our state-of-the-art educational facility on. So it was truly a blessing to be able to win that award to help us create the vision on what we want the best of the batch building to be.
Man, that's cool, man. So I'm glad I did bring that up. But you had said so many other good things about it. I mean, I guess there's an infinite number of things that can happen with your foundation. And I'm always, even though I'm in North Carolina and here and there, I'm always willing to help you, man.
I appreciate it.
And I enjoy putting smiles on people's faces, whether it's, you know, someone in need or just in general, just doing something nice for somebody.
But you think about where we were at and years ago at the beginning, you come out to the event, you support it, I appreciated it. And now kind of seeing where it is, you know, here we are 8 years later, you were there from the beginning. And let's not forget that.
Yeah.
So I appreciate from back in the day when when you supported me.
And I always say on this show, you are what you think. And that leads into my last segment with you, which is kind of have some fun with this. And I got that from a book called The Secret, because basically if you think positive things come around your life. Mm-hmm. If you're always dreading things and being negative and miserable, then misery loves company is really true. So I say you are what you think in this podcast. So whatever comes to your mind for these, I call it the extra points segment. These are just random questions and they're funny. So have fun with it. The first question I have is, what chore do you absolutely hate doing?
Dishes.
Yeah, well, I don't have but a I choice do. Now. I date a chef. So to eat the damn good food, I have to clean up.
Correct.
And I'll be honest, I feel bad for my mom back in the day when she cooked every damn night. I just put my plate in the sink.
And we kept walking.
And just, I'm full. Let me go lay down. And now I'm like, you know, I don't, I get no affection and I get no, I get yelled at if I don't do the damn dishes. Right. It's an expectation, not I hope you do the dishes. Well, when we're done with dinner, give your plate to Jeff.
Right.
And I'm like, shit, that's my own fault.
Now you trust me. I understand.
I should have known that. Should have learned that long ago. So I can relate. But I don't necessarily enjoy doing it, but it's one of those things where I actually really do enjoy doing it because it puts a smile on her face.
Right.
And
there you
takes
go.
A little bit of a, little bit of her work off of her shoulders. So, second, name one thing on your bucket list.
At this point, my bucket list would probably be a half marathon, but my knees are so bad that I probably would never accomplish that. I don't know if I'd be able to run that half marathon. My knees are swelled up so
maybe
bad.
Maybe they have one on grass.
Maybe I can ride my bike.
maybe they have one on like that squishy like material that your knees can hold up on. All right. Well, yeah, I could see that. When I saw Hines going through his Ironman thing, I really respect that. I mean, that's ridiculous how great a shape you have to be. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could do the swimming part. The other stuff, I think I can. But I always wondered because I saw, you know, the people are like, why don't you just run a marathon? I'm like, first of all, it's 26 miles.
Right.
I don't see a point in that. I mean, unless I get first. And those Kenyans will probably beat me.
Yeah, they're done in about 2 hours, and you'll be sitting around the halfway point.
I'm like, man, I just finished the first mile. These dudes are done with 26. But, I don't know. The half marathon, maybe. Marathon, I don't even see a point in it.
Yeah,
unless one day I'm just someone challenges me and it's like a bet or something, and I actually win money off it.
That's the only way, yes.
Yeah. All right, third, what song is included on the soundtrack of your life? And I'll give you a second to think about this, and I'll tell you on mine just because it'll be easy, because that kind of puts you on the spot. I picked Justin Timberlake, What Goes Around Comes Around.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not because I'm a huge Timberlake fan, not that I'm not, but it's the song. You know, it's true. You know, if you treat someone in the wrong way, even at that instant, you may be okay. You may get off with it, but it'll come back around to bite your ass.
Right.
Or if you do something nice, someone takes advantage of you, it'll come back to, you know, someone to do something nice for you as well. So what's on your soundtrack of your life?
I don't know, because I don't listen to much music. I wish I had an answer.
That's good. So your life is pretty boring is what you're saying.
It pretty much is.
Well, that's good, because that was a terrible answer. But, you know, it's that's okay. At least you didn't. Everything else has been so professional and good. I finally stunned you on one. All right, fourth, we got two left. Have you ever cried during a movie, and don't lie? And tearing up counts.
Yeah, I have before. Actually, I teared up whenever I was watching Moneyball. And people are like, how the heck do you cry watching baseball? And I'm sitting there watching, and I remember a part in that movie, and he had to make a tough decision. General manager for the Oakland A's had to make a tough decision, and he wanted to go, and they presented him with this $12, $20 million check, whatever it may have been, to move to the Boston Red Sox. And he's really seriously contemplating making this move, and he hears this song because it's his daughter, and his daughter plays this song for him, and he knew that this was, I mean, it was the way that they kind of put that in there, and you knew it wasn't about the money, it was about family, and he didn't want to move across the country and leave his daughter, and it was something that was, it was a surreal moment to me. I'm just like, wow, because there were many opportunities that I had to leave home and leave Pittsburgh and for the right thing, but it wasn't about the money in that particular situation. It was about trying to make that impact, and for me, it was here in Pittsburgh, but in that movie, it was in Oakland. And that was a touching moment for me. So, yeah, I did actually tear up for that.
Well, I teared up for Sweet Home Alabama, so my story's not as good as a love story, a chick flick. But, no, and the last question I always ask all of my guests is, you know, because everyone has their opinions of me. If you don't know me, you can say I'm a jackass because I hit a paper towel dispenser. If you do know me, you know, I'm sure I've been rude to somebody, and they think I'm a rude person if I only met them once, but people have their opinions that are very positive as well. So who is Jeff Reed to you?
Jeff Reed, he's a funny dude, honestly. He's a guy that people didn't get a chance to really know because they didn't have the time to spend like I did. But when you watch him, you see how hard he worked. He was a guy that came off the street in 2002, literally, because he didn't have a job and we were having kicker problems. And here was a guy that came in and actually off the street. What do you make, 5 field goals that day? 6? Down in Jacksonville?
6. Yeah.
Made 6 field goals down in Jacksonville that day. And everybody found, trying to figure out, who the hell is Jeff Reed? Where did this guy come from?
I was trying to figure it out, too.
Why is he out of a job? I think that was something that people were trying to figure out. But those were things then that I remember. And I'm just like, wow, to see where you came from and to the point of having an opportunity to kick in a Super Bowl. And I remember what your dream was, and this was talking to you, was Super Bowl 40. And everyone kicker's dream is to kick the first kickoff. And there you were kicking that first. And you
blinded.
Yeah. You were blinded with all the lights. Yeah. And you could see that and you can actually watch it on TV. But I took myself to that moment and saying, well, damn, here's Jeff Reed out here. I'm excited just standing on the sideline watching the kickoff. But here you were having an opportunity to kick that ball off with the lights, man. That was special to be able to see. But you take it through those moments, man, and having the opportunity to watch you grow as a person, to see kind of where you are now, but where you started, because a lot of people don't get that opportunity. Man, you worked your tail off to get to that point of respectability. Should have made the Pro Bowl a couple of times, but you didn't because other names of the other name recognition. But to see how hard it was to kick in Heinz Field and do some of the things that you were able to do, man, people took it for granted. And I think they didn't realize how hard it was to kick in Heinz Field, but do it under pressure situations the way that you were, man. You're a stand-up guy, had an opportunity to learn, get a chance to know you, get a chance to know your family. Man, I love you, man. Get a chance to your brother. And that's something that you sit back and you accomplish something special. And when you accomplish something special, that was something that always takes me back to Super Bowl 40, because we all did it together. And there was only one person on that team that went to the Super Bowl, and that was Willie Williams. But he went and lost. So when you have 52 guys that were all going through that Super Bowl moment and being able to embrace and hold that Lombardi trophy up and celebrate it in that room and come back to Pittsburgh and go through that Super Bowl parade, that was something that was not done here in 25 years. But that was to be something that we will always share that memory to be able to come back. And regardless of how everything unfolds and how people may feel about me, about you, we will all come back one day together. And that will be fairly soon, because here we are already in 2014. But 10 years comes next year when we get a chance to mark that Super Bowl 40 and we all get a chance to come back and celebrate that moment that will never be taken away from us when we shine that Super Bowl ring up. And yeah, we can go back and get, you know, the second one. But it's that moment that when you sit back and, you know, when people talk about a bond and talk about families, that you're able to get a chance. And when we sat back in that tent in Detroit after winning that Super Bowl, man, and all the family were together, man, that was a special moment. We sit back and we embrace with a hug, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah, man, and I got the chills. I need to go take Sweezum's job back, my job back, I guess, from Sweezum. I feel like I need to go on the damn field right now. But, yeah, man, it was a great great moment. I'll never forget it. And I wish I talked to more guys, but you know, the handful of guys I do keep in touch with, it's like we were back on the field yesterday.
Absolutely. But it's always something you got to remember, that the game will be taken away from us at some point. Yep. It's a matter of how long we can prolong
that.
Yeah,
I realized actually this season that I was being greedy. Most people just, to have the opportunity to put a college football uniform on is cool to them, and it was cool to me, of course. But to play 9 years at the highest level and you to play 15 at the highest level of football, just for us to go play one game is more than most can say they ever.
Absolutely. Get and when you play here in Pittsburgh, they're always going to embrace you back. And when no matter how, you know, and everyone leaves differently, however it might be, but to still be able to come in, walk through a building freely, people love you, people still get a chance, and they show that respect. That's what's appreciated, because you know, you may not take that for granted. And now here I am 2 years out the game, and I still have an opportunity to walk into that building. But it's tough, because now you walk in as that former player.
Yep. And you know what you left there.
Correct. And you're just like, wow. But it makes you appreciate it. But at the same time, understanding that we played a game that was a business. The business of the NFL owners, you understand it, that now that you kind of move through it and understand that, wait a minute, it is a business. You don't take it personal. And that's something that I was able to do to make sure that I'm able to separate the two and be able to still walk through, shake Mr. Rooney's hand, thank him for changing my life, that opportunity to reach platforms that I may never have had the opportunity to do so, but also make sure that, hey, you're able to share some of that knowledge with the players that are coming through, because they can never take those moments away from you, because you're sharing the knowledge and you're just trying to pass it on. And that was something that we have the opportunity to do with these younger players, regardless of where you may relocate at. At some point, you'll be back here twice. I don't care how it unfolds, you will be back here twice. Yep. You'll be back here next year, and you'll be back here in 3 more years to celebrate Super Bowl 43.
That's right, man. That'd so, be cool.
However it is, we will always be back here, because our picture will always be on that wall. They can never take that down.
And if they do, then they can't erase history. That's for damn
Absolutely.
Sure. But Charlie, I appreciate you coming. This is Charlie Batch once again. I appreciate you coming on Barely Controlled Radio.
Absolutely.
It's time for you to get out of this man cave and get back to work, change some lives, and you know, help some lives, man.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. And literally, man, if anybody want to follow what I do, they can go to charliebatch.com.
Yeah, check out his website. Continue to listen to these podcasts. I told you it's going to get better, and it wasn't just me blowing smoke up your ass. These guests are teaching me things, and changing lives is huge for me. And it's not just through radio I'm talking about. I'm talking about what Charlie does and how I can contribute to him and other things and the Charlotte community as well. And I appreciate you listening. You are what you think. Thank you.
That's all the time we've got for today. Barely Controlled Radio can be heard live every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. We hope you'll join Jeff Reed for another great show next week.